Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia EV6, the fully electric EV6 with a range of up to 528 kilometres. For more, visit kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Good afternoon, I'm Damien O'Reilly and this is Liveline. 51551 is the text. Jerk Harty, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Damien.
When did you hear that a plane had crashed there in Wexford? When did you find out about it?
Approximately 5:30 yesterday evening. I was just sitting down to my dinner. I'm the ambulance officer for County Wexford, but also a local independent county councillor. So I was informed by from the National Emergency Operations Centre that a four-seater plane had crashed off of Cairnsthorne Point, which is in the same parish as I live. Probably only about 3 or 4 minutes from my home place.
Right. And you're a first responder, that's why you were contacted.
Yeah, well, I'm an ambulance officer, but I'm also an advanced paramedic, so I get a page for all those incidents throughout County Wexford, so that's the reason I got the call.
Right. And would they be common, Ger?
I suppose in my career, 20 years, I've had 4 plane crashes. The last one was a double fatality, but this one was more fortunate, and thankfully there was a successful conclusion to this one. But they are quite common for, I suppose, two-seater planes across the country from time to time.
Yeah.
The Air Accident Investigation Unit would say that it's common enough occurrence, maybe every 3 to 4 weeks, they'd have to go and investigate an incident. Similar to what happened, I suppose, off Cairnsthorne Point yesterday evening.
Yeah. So what did happen? What was the scene when you arrived?
When I arrived, it's quite a remote area. It's down a kind of very long lane, a dirt track lane, but when I looked out to the shoreline, you could see the tail of the plane up, nose of the plane in the sea, and 4 of the occupants on the shoreline. So there's a bit of a trek across to get to them. But when I arrived there was 2 civilians, one that had raised the alarm, and so I assessed the situation, you know, done the normal sort and see to see who's the most serious and what resources are required. But fortunately, Rescue 117 from Waterford was overhead within a few minutes, and their same qualification as ourselves, like the paramedics and advanced paramedics. So when they landed, you know, we got the wheels in motion in relation to the evacuation of the most serious. Rescue 117 from Waterford airlifted one to Waterford University Hospital, and the Dublin Coast Guard helicopter 116 lifted the second one to Waterford University, and then our own resources from the National Ambulance Service Wexford transported 2 other patients to Wexford General Hospital. But I think it was a multi-agency response to an incident, a mass casualty incident that hasn't been seen in probably the south of the country or even in the south of County Wexford in many, many years. So I'd like to congratulate everyone that was involved in that. But fortunately, I think through the actions of the pilot, he managed to save the lives of his 3 counterparts yesterday evening at 5:30 when he brought that plane down. And he was able to keep it out of the sea, because I think if it had went in there, there's a very strong undercurrent. You can't swim in that area of the beach. And rescuers wouldn't have been able to get out. And again, the lifeboat would have come around from Rossler Harbour. You could have been talking half an hour. So I think his swift action, you know, he told them to brace for impact and he took it down as best he could. And I know there's a number of injuries. I can't get into that naturally enough with you.
Yeah.
But and I'm not a spokesman for the HSE. I'm talking to you in my capacity as an independent councillor. But, I think that the emergency services really stepped up to the mark. They train hard to play hard, and they played hard yesterday evening. And we brought it to a successful conclusion. With the support, I have to say, of the local community, they were down there. A number of them helped to secure the plane for the Air Accident Investigation Unit. And they were there early till midnight last night, with works being done with diggers to try and lift the aircraft up onto the bank. And as I say, in the fullness of time, the investigation will tell us what exactly did happen. But it was fortunate that it worked out the way it worked out yesterday evening.
And as far from your analysis and your surveillance of the crash site, did the plane nosedive, or did it land and then the front propeller get caught in the sand and came to a sudden stop? How do you think it landed?
He more or less glided it in. It was a twin prop plane. He got into difficulty about a mile off Cairnsthorne Point. He missed a local land area of the West Rock, and he came about 500 metres up onto the beach. Along by the shore, away from the rocks. So he kind of glided in, and then naturally enough, it stuck in the sand and kind of bellied up, spitting kind of half in the engine back. So they were fortunate, you know, that the the pilot and indeed the person sitting beside him weren't fatally injured, you know.
So it seems that he did absolutely the best job he could in the circumstances and the area that he was in.
Absolutely, and I don't know the man's name. He's in his early 50s. But
he's been hailed a hero, yeah.
Hailed a hero, and maybe you can track him down. But yeah. I don't personally.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there, as you said, which is normal in circumstances like this, there is an air accident investigation unit at the scene, and there'll be a full investigation carried out as to what happened and how it happened and all of that. But you were obviously very relieved, like on your way from your house, the few minutes down to Cairnsore Point. There, were you fearing the worst when you heard a plane had gone down?
Yeah, it was, because it's a very remote area. You know, you've the two oceans meet each other. You've rocks. You've the shoreline. You know, you've also the wind. There's 15 or 16 wind turbines just off Cairnsore Point. So look, when you hear of a plane crash, you think the worst. The adrenaline starts to pump. But naturally, all the training and all that we have, you know, kicks in when you get there, and we do our best to bring it to a successful conclusion, which I believe we done yesterday evening. Yeah. And well done to everyone that was indeed involved in that, as I said. Even to the local community coffee shop we have in Ladies Island, the ladies up there put on sandwiches and stuff for the emergency services after. So, I mean, it was a whole community effort yesterday evening from about 5:30 till probably midnight last night. The Air Accident Investigation Unit are there as we speak, and I believe the plane has been transported to Dublin now later on in the afternoon.
Yeah, and like again, not going into too much detail, but the passengers on the plane, when you arrived and you saw that they were safe, huge relief. They must have been very shocked, were they?
Absolutely, sure. Look at it. If you're on a four-seater plane and you're told to brace for impact, naturally enough, you're going to be in shock and the fear, you know, that will develop before you hit the ground must be unbelievable. Like it's our job is quite easy towards what they had to face as a group on that plane when they lost their two engines. Well, we're led to believe they lost their two engines, but I suppose the investigation, the fullness of time, will say or will tell us exactly what did happen.
Yeah, and it was flying quite low. It was on a marine surveillance mission, I believe, isn't that right?
Yeah, we're led to believe that that's what they were working at. There may have been students from University College Cork, I think, but I can't confirm that, but that's what we're led to believe. But they were surveying a maritime area in relation to maybe whales and dolphins, etc. But, you know, that and ran into some difficulty maybe a kilometre off Cairnsore Point and, you know, ended up on the beach and partly in the sea later on that evening. But I mean, the response was unbelievable from the emergency service in the time frame that they arrived there. And could I also thank both Coast Guard helicopters, 116 from Dublin and indeed 117 from Waterford, for the prompt action.
Yeah, marvellous people they are indeed.
And I know it's important that we protect and maintain those services, because they've been under threat in relation to, you know, maybe removing the Coast Guard helicopter from Waterford. That's a vital piece of life-saving equipment that we can't as a community afford to lose. So I think any tampering with the current service that we have wouldn't be welcome. I encourage the government to support it and fund it going forward for another decade of contract.
Yeah. And as you say, like it seems the emergency operation there yesterday ran as smoothly as possible. You don't want to obviously have to implement an emergency operation like that, of course, and the less we have of them, obviously, the better. But it worked really well. I'm just wondering, was it a miracle that there were no people on the ground? Like, is that a busy beach? You know, at another time of the day, would people have been there?
I suppose it's an area that you can't swim in because of the undercurrent that pulls you. Right. But there's a lot of people fish down there, and one of the men that raised the alarm was actually just getting ready to go fishing when the plane went over and dropped from the sky. Now, I spoke to him later on. He was nearly in as much shock as the pilot was because, you know, picking out a fishing rod and next minute the plane drops. And, you know, he was first there. He hadn't been first aid trained. And he said, you know, it's something I'm going to do in the future. But he done his best. You know, he kept him calm. He rang 999. And, you know, the resources and the helicopters and the land ambulances and the Coast Guard and the Guardian Fire were all there, you know, and as quick as possible time that you could get to a very remote area of County Wexford.
Yeah. Now, they wouldn't have been able to make it back to Waterford. It's a bit too far away to the airport. There was no other way of landing that plane.
He had to ditch it either in the sea or, as he did, fortunately, just barely out, just barely in the sea and on the shoreline.
Yeah. Well, Ger, well done to everybody there yesterday for involved in that operation, as you said, and we wish a speedy recovery to the four occupants. And as you said,
absolutely, and I concur with that. As just on behalf of the emergency service, my expert, yeah. wish the four occupants a speedy recovery.
Yeah, and you know, well done to the pilot as well, and we hope they all make a full recovery. Okay, Councillor Ger Carthy, first responder and independent councillor there in Wexford. Thank you very much for talking to us on the programme. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at rte.ie. Now, we've been hearing this week that from Monday, close contacts of COVID cases in schools will no longer be contacted and won't have to isolate or stay away unless or get tests or anything like that, unless of course they show symptoms themselves. And it's a further, I suppose, sign of the relaxation around COVID in getting back to normal. But for a lot of parents, it's not good enough and they're very worried. And I've a couple of them on the line here. Niamh Shine is there. Niamh, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you, Damien?
You have four children.
I do. I have four children, three of them in regular primary school, and I have one daughter with a lot of complications who is in a special school.
Right.
At the moment.
So contact tracing is stopping from Monday next, and you're upset about that.
I am upset about that. I mean, for all of my children, I think it's a concern. We've been kind of going with the guidelines for the duration of all of this. We have been doing everything we're supposed to do. We've been taking probably extra precautions in our house, not letting the kids go back to activities and stuff in an extended way to sort of protect Ava. And to be honest, what we've been doing is making informed decisions. And my feeling now is that from Monday, we can't make an informed decision because we're not being given information. We won't even have to be told that there's a case in any of our children's classes. Which means that for me, what I would do, because we did weigh it up and send the kids back and all of that so they could get back to normal a little bit, you would steer them away from very, very close contact with their sister or extended close contact with their sister, or certainly their friends wouldn't be coming in if you knew there was a case in the class. But from Monday, that is all going to change and we're not even going to be given that basic information. I mean, we wouldn't need names or anything, but we would need to know it's sort of in the general vicinity of one of our children's classes.
Yeah, because your daughter is vulnerable.
My daughter is vulnerable. My daughter has many, many conditions. She's intellectually and physically disabled. She has respiratory issues. She has very serious epilepsy. She has a VP shunt. She has many, many kind of co-conditions with her underlying condition, if you like. And we don't know. I mean, maybe she would be one of the lucky ones who wouldn't be badly affected. But to be quite honest, that's a risk that I'm not prepared to take without information and without as much information as I can and without doing everything I can to make sure that she is safe. And this decision on Monday, it is like, so special needs schools are being treated differently. They will be still contact traced and there will be a period of isolation. But in our case, I mean, generally Ava School anyway, a lot of the kids are in wheelchairs, the staff are masked, they do a lot of personal care, so they're well used to that sort of dealing with that anyway. The risk is coming from her sibling school. And from Monday, we won't know where that risk is. We'll be in a position, we'll be working blind on it. And I mean, unless I'm expected to take all of my children out of school, which I don't think I can do for their mental health and for their general well-being, I can't do that. But I mean, it's my responsibility to keep my daughter safe. But to do that, I need information. And that's just stopping from Monday. I mean, you would think that these children exist in a vacuum. These children are going home. Primary school children are going home to homes with, in our case, a vulnerable sibling, potentially a vulnerable parent who's undergoing chemotherapy or is a cancer survivor or whatever condition, to the grandparents. And from Monday, we won't know the risk that's coming home. And I just don't think it's good enough. It's a cohort of children that are too young to be vaccinated, there's no mask mandate. The government have been really negligent in getting the work done for the proper ventilation and filters and all of that. Because I believe wherever they bought their filters, they were faulty. So they're not in schools. So, I mean, I'm trying to do the best I can, but that is not being helped by this decision in any way, shape or form. In fact, they're putting my daughter's life at risk and the lives of many other vulnerable children and vulnerable people generally around the country at risk as well. And with no explanation. I mean, I don't know whether they're trying to make it seem like it is not a problem in schools or it doesn't exist in schools. Because the sure way to do that is to not track it, and therefore there will be no data about what's happening in schools. It's beyond comprehension at this point in time, having done everything that we've been advised to do over the duration of this.
Yeah.
I cannot believe we're at this point.
Well, Professor Philip Nolan of Maynooth University and Neffet as well, he says opening schools has had little effect on transmission of the virus. A massive increase in testing has detected only a modest number of additional cases, and the risks of allowing asymptomatic in-school contacts to continue schooling is low. I think we might have a clip of what he had to say on the News at One.
I think one thing that we need to appreciate is that the risk of transmission varies from setting to setting, and there's behavioural and environmental reasons for that. And it transpires that even with Delta, the risk is quite low in school settings. So typically, a case in a school might infect somewhere between 2 and 5% of its close contacts, whereas the same case in a household setting is typically infecting somewhere between 30 and 50%.
So there he says the risk is quite low, and a case in a school setting, only 2 to 5% of close contacts will be infected. So he's basing it on a risk analysis.
He is, of course, and I don't have access to the data that he has, but there's a couple of points I would make. Mm-hmm. My children, if they pick it up in school, are coming home to a household setting. So therefore, the transmission in the household setting is going to be quite significant, presumably. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's by using his own logic, using the data that he has presented there. The second thing is that, like, I am 100% not a conspiracy theorist, but I, in our school, in a couple of the classes of my children in the last couple of weeks, there have been cases. And on the parents' WhatsApp, I'm able to see that the HSE have not arranged the testing. So the testing has been done by parents themselves, which, as far as I'm aware, and I am open to correction, but I'm pretty sure I'm right, is not registered as school transmission. It's registered as community transmission, which is a different category. So my fear here is that the numbers we're being given, really, transmission in schools, are maybe not 100% accurate.
Yeah,
because they can't say, like, I mean, they probably can't trace.
Yeah.
Quite deliberately, it seems to me, because they're not actually doing the work.
Well, I'm just wondering, though, Niamh, at what stage would you be happy that we no longer, have contact tracing in schools? At what stage, what level?
At the stage where a significant amount of primary school pupils can be and are vaccinated.
Okay.
I don't think that's too much to ask. I mean, I think that's the way I want everything back to normal as well. I want my other children living their lives as normally as they can. But I don't think we should be throwing the vulnerable section of society who can't be vaccinated for whatever reason, whether it's their age or their immune suppressed condition or whatever. I think if we can protect them and still let everyone get back to normal, we should. And that's the way to do it.
OK, I want to bring Samantha in, because Samantha, good afternoon. You've a similar, I suppose, worry in your house.
Yeah. Hi, Damien. I have four children. I have two teenagers in secondary school, a mainstream 9-year-old who's actually asthmatic, and I have a 6-year-old little girl who has a rare genetic syndrome. She has serious epilepsy, an intellectual disability, a physical disability. She is reliant on everybody around her for every need, and she attends a special school. And when I read the headlines, I was both angry and absolutely terrified. And as the 48 hours have gone on and more information is being released, I have even less confidence now that I will be able to keep COVID out of my house. Because we're at the stage now where the HSE guidelines are actually stating that it is not on the principals to inform anybody of any cases in the school. So the principals are not being informed by the HSE. The principals are relying on parents to inform them of the COVID cases were in their schools. And then they have to then see if they are allowed to divulge that information to the school body. So I may never know whether there's a case in my son's school at all. So not only do I have to worry about whether he's going to come to harm because he's asthmatic, and he's autistic, I have to worry about him bringing it home and infecting my 6-year-old daughter, who this year has already been hospitalised for pneumonia. Then she came home and had a second bout of pneumonia, and he's only just getting better over those two bouts of pneumonia and has already been floored this week by the cold virus that is going around the schools, which was brought into the house by a sibling. Mm-hmm. So that's how fast she goes down. And it's all been brought on her by a sibling. So the likelihood of her contracting COVID from a sibling is extremely high.
And does that impact on her siblings as well? Are they worried that they might bring something back into the house?
My 9-year-old is petrified that he is going to give her COVID. And it's not anything that we said. It's nothing that we've done. They see what's going on around them. They hear what's going on around them. He wears a mask on the bus. He wears a mask off the bus. He wears a mask around school. He wears a mask when he goes into a shop. He is constantly hand washing and sanitizing because he is so worried that he is going to give her COVID. Because she doesn't leave the house. In over 18 months, the only time she's left the house is to go on one single solitary trip where we booked an entire barge out so there would be nobody else on it except family and to school. She hasn't left the house except for those two reasons in 18 months.
What age is she again?
She's six.
And
We've done everything that they have asked of us in the 18 months. We have vaccinated everybody in the house that can be vaccinated. We have limited our contacts. My two teenage boys don't go out and hang around with their friends, even though they're fully vaccinated. My younger son, all he goes out for is school, and he goes to one swim class a week. And we decided to keep him in his swim class because he's autistic, and he's around a pool full of chlorine. So we thought it was one of the low-risk things that he would be able to do, which he wears a mask into the building and a mask out of the building, and it's all instigated by himself. And right now, all it feels like is that we are being continually failed. It's like they keep saying the vulnerable have been vaccinated, and yet I'm looking at my six-year-old unvaccinated daughter going, she's vulnerable.
And at what stage, as far as you're aware, will your nine-year-old, for example, be able to get a vaccine to reduce the risk?
I'm following the data of the vaccine trials, and Pfizer released data this week on the 5 to 11 cohort studies that they've done, which in my understanding of the paper work that I've read means that within the next month it will be approved by the FDA and start being used in America. And normally once it starts getting used in America, you're looking at about 3 months before the European Medical Agency allow it, and then hopefully Ireland by January will be giving it to vulnerable family members and hopefully their siblings.
Yeah, so you're in agreement with Niamh. Until then, contact tracing should continue in primary schools.
Yeah, because if I don't have the information, I can't make a decision. Like, we tried pulling our children from school. We tried keeping them home. And my nine-year-old ended up hurting himself at home because he lost everything. And he can't deal with the lack of routine. He can't deal with staying in four walls all the time and not being able to do things that he would use for self-regulation. And my six-year-old literally went from this lovely, chatty, sociable child into a child who sat there and stared at a wall and refused to interact with us. Like, we tried keeping them home. And right now, we're at the stage where we're having to balance trying to keep them healthy and trying to keep them in one peaceful stop. Because if I keep them home again, what kind of state are they going to be into this time? Because it's 18 months into this now.
And what is the, if you don't mind me asking, I think you did share it with us, though, in your email to us. What is the condition that your daughter has?
She has a syndrome called Wolff-Hirschhorn syndrome. It's a genetic deletion that was non-hereditary. It's 1 in 50,000, and it's not something we kind of expected, because you don't expect something that's spontaneous.
And has she had this all her life? Or?
She was born with it.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a condition that you're born with. We'll be lucky if she has a long life. Over the last 18 months, I've seen children with her condition pass away from numerous things. Like, we know what it's like to live in a world where sickness can hurt us. She is fully vaccinated for everything else. The whole family get flu vaccines. The two younger ones have had chickenpox vaccines, everything, because we know how we need to keep safe, but we can't keep safe if they keep withholding the information from us.
And what you're obviously full-time carer for your daughter as well. I mean, how tough has it been over the last 18 months knowing that there is a virus out there that has the potential to harm her quite a lot? I mean, we're all concerned and worried about vulnerable loved ones and trying to get on with our lives, but it must be really, really terrible for parents like both of you who have a child that is vulnerable and not knowing at any stage when the virus will come into the house.
For us, it
must be nerve-wracking.
It is. You're constantly living on edge, because it's not just worrying about whether we get the virus. It's whether how do we get the virus? So we've had to limit when we go out, where we go out. We didn't have therapies for months because they redeployed staff. We haven't had hospital appointments because they redeployed staff and shut it down for COVID. So even with all the other worries, you're living a life on edge because you're just, it's so hard to explain. You're just shut into your house because you can't risk going outside and bringing it home.
I feel like people have gotten, for the first time, have gotten a little taste of what living with something like this is. But it seems like they're being very quick to forget what it is to live with a threat like this.
So while the rest of us somewhat let our guard down now that we're vaccinated and everything is opening up again, things haven't changed a bit for you, Niamh, really?
Not very much. We have made calculated risks and taken decisions that probably people might think are risky. I mean, my children are back in primary school, but like Sam said, I mean, I've had to weigh that up. So, it's on me, I suppose. But from next week, I won't even have the information to make the calculated decision, and the informed decision. And that, like, we go through our children's whole lives weighing things up. Like, I get a chicken pox notice from the school and I'm on alert. Those sorts of things matter more in our household than they do in other households. And this is, I feel like we're at the most risky time for my children at the moment, to be quite honest, because they're out in the world and now I won't even know how close they are to this.
Yeah, so like for some people that think it's great, that it's another sign we're moving another step forward, that this has been relaxed from Monday, there are people in your situation who have really genuine concerns because you have vulnerable children at home. But look, thanks for getting in touch with us on that. And mind yourselves, both of you, Niamh, and your families as well. That's Niamh and Samantha. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Yeah, and we have another mother on the line who is very concerned about her daughter, but it's her adult daughter. Because Paula, good afternoon to you. It's exactly a week now, I think, last Friday, that your world came tumbling down.
That's correct, Damien, yes. My daughter had been complaining of an eye problem since July. She'd been going to her eye specialist, going to an optician, mm-hmm. where they were testing her eyes, and she just kept saying, "I'm going blind in one eye." And then she said her peripheral vision was gone. So she went back to her optician last Friday, and when she said her peripheral vision was impaired, I think that sent alarm bells to the optician, who suggested she take herself directly to the matter. Mm-hmm. So she did that, and she had a series of tests on Friday evening, and she was admitted, and she was told she has a brain tumour. They couldn't say whether it was malignant or benign. That can't be determined until she has surgery. And they said it was imperative that she have surgery. They thought we were talking about time frame 24 to 48 hours. And now we're a week later and she's still in the matter, still awaiting a bed in Beaumont, which is the centre of excellence for brain surgery.
So a week on, you're still waiting. You're actually with your daughter now, I believe, in the matter.
I was with her when I was talking to a researcher, but actually she got too upset with, all the activity. I have written to Minister Donnelly today, and, there's been a lot of, when I contacted you, because joke, it's a lot done, and hopefully Minister Donnelly will get something done today. Everybody thinks their own daughter is, the most important daughter in the world. But the fact of the matter is, we're not waiting for a hip here or a knee or something like that. She has a tumour, we were told, 5 centimetres by 5 centimetres by 3.5. I'm wondering if how bad does she have to get before something is really done? There's a queue here. And in the meantime, she's in a bed in the matter, holding a bed, blocking a bed for somebody else. And you are
desperate to get her to Beaumont because it is a centre of excellence for brain traumas.
Correct. And that's what we've been told she needs.
That's what she needs. And you were under the impression from last Friday that by the end of the weekend she would be in surgery in Beaumont, but a week on, you're still waiting.
Correct. Yes, initially they said 24 to 48 hours, and then the doctor in the matter said, well, could be a bit longer. Mm. And then he said, we had a lady recently, and she was here 3 weeks.
And they said,
that won't happen to your daughter because she's more urgent. The other lady didn't show as many symptoms. But at the end of the day, that other lady still has a brain tumour.
Sure.
And it needs to come out.
And even in the last week since the diagnosis, how has your daughter's condition been?
Well, she has deteriorated. She's getting stuck for words. She's forgetting things. She gave me a message to bring home, and then she asked me the same thing again. She just is not herself. She started having seizures on Wednesday, and the answer to that was, well, that would be perfectly normal, so we'll give her medication to deal with the seizures.
Yeah. And tell me as much as you want about your daughter, Patricia, or Paula.
She's 33. She's almost 34 years of age. She's a practicing barrister. She's fun-loving. She's intelligent. She's beautiful. Well, we all think our daughters are beautiful. And her and I were actually away last week for a few days because she needed a few days away after all the stress that we've all gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And she, her and I went away for 4 days to take a little break. And before we went away, I asked her to go to the Ioneer. She said, no, I'm not going. And she said, look, I'll make another appointment for the optician. And we flew home on Thursday night, and she had an appointment at lunchtime on Friday with the optician.
God, and that's when things took a nasty turn.
When we were away, the peripheral vision, the way it affects her, she was all bruised. She kept, we were in a restaurant and there was an ice bucket attached, you know, one of these attached to the side of a table,
mm-hmm.
and she walked straight into it and battered the side of herself. She never saw it.
So she knew, so that has been happening, as you said, since July.
July, that's been.
And was she, you know, healthy, never had any problems before?
No, very young, obviously.
Yeah.
Very young, not overweight, not underweight, no other issues, no. And, a professional in her field and works hard, and it's the last thing we expected, you know.
And Paula, so you wrote to Minister Donnelly today to ask him what did you say? You don't have to read the letter out in full, what's the main thrust of your letter to Minister Donnelly?
I'm asking him to please find a bed for Rachel for surgery that she needs. That's all we need. That's what we've been told we need. And, you know, the doctors in the matter are very, very nice. And they said, but, like, our hands are tied. And we just, I mean, we know the crisis. And we've had, as far as I can see, we've had an increase in population in the country in the last few years. And, you know, the health service just hasn't kept up with it.
So,
centres of...
what is your understanding? Just remind me again of why, what are you being told, or why do you think there is this delay?
Well, it's priority, and they said she's stable. They're monitoring her. She does need the surgery, but she's obviously not priority. And
so there's a queue. There's a queue
basically a queue.
And she's in it.
You know, and she's in it. And, you know, I said to her, like, 2 days after she was there, I said, no, fingers crossed there isn't a bad road traffic accident on a motorway today somewhere in the country, because I said those unfortunate people would end up in Beaumont, and then you're not, you know, as crisis.
These are all the things going through your head, yeah.
These are all the things. So in the meantime, you know, people are, if she had had any notion, or if anybody, if you had a notion that it was going to develop into this, if she'd gone to, I feel if she'd gone to Beaumont first, she would have been.
Well, I was going to say that, but what if you checked out of the matter and presented in A&E in Beaumont?
Well, we did consider that because we were told that's what a lot of people are doing. We did consider that. I was very desperate last night, and my ex-husband, Tom, and Rachel's partner, Emmett, were in with her, and I phoned them and I said, listen, would you not take her out of there? Just bring her to Beaumont. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, if they did that, it's my understanding she'd be on a trolley for, could be 36 hours, and she would be, you know, she obviously wouldn't be on the medication and getting the care. Like, they are looking after her very well in the matter, but monitoring her. She's like, normally when people go into hospital, you expect them to be treated, improve, and discharged.
Yeah.
But she is holding a bed for somebody else could use for another ailment, and she's holding it because she's not ready. She's in a queue.
Is some of this to do with COVID as well? You know, that there's a backlog. Are you relating it at all to that?
I don't know, but I mean, like, maybe if it was hips or knees, you could relate it to that. But I mean,
this is an emergency.
A brain tumor. You're dealing with something completely different.
Well,
it's
very hard to think of too many other things that could happen to you that you would consider to be more of an emergency. You know, like a brain tumor that's been diagnosed, you want it dealt with as quickly as possible. How is Rachel herself coping? How concerned are you for her yourself?
And I'm concerned for her. She was crying a lot yesterday. She was in better form this morning, but again, the better form, she's on Oxynorm for the pain, and maybe it's making her happy. I don't know the side effects of these things. They're monitoring her. Now, I presume they've given her anti-seizure medication because it's normal to have a seizure with this tumour, but it's not normal for a 33-year-old to have a tumour. You know, we just need her in a bed. We need her in Beaumont. I'm not blaming the doctors. You know, there's a queue here, and what I'm afraid of is we don't know either if it's benign or malignant, because that can't be clarified until they do a biopsy, and they're not going to do a biopsy. They said they won't do a biopsy until they open her and take the tumour out,
sure.
And then the biopsy, then they'll be able to tell us.
And I'm just wondering, like, it's a last resort, obviously, to write to the minister. Are you expecting a response, or?
Well, I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
But I mean, the facts of the matter is, if I get a response and, you know, they move her quickly, well, then somebody else isn't. But, you know, as a parent, you do everything within your power to do. And that's why I'm trying to highlight it with yourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just afraid that even after she has the surgery, the more it's delayed, the more likely of complications, or, you know, I don't want to hear something later on like, oh, she needs speech therapy for months, or because if we got this earlier now, this wouldn't have arisen. Now, I know I'm totally speculating, but,
she pays health insurance, you're saying, as well, so it's not a case of, you know, oh, well, you go private, you get in quicker.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to highlight that fact because I didn't want to sound like, oh, well, we should be looked after better because we have health insurance. But now that you mention it...
a statement of fact that it makes no difference in this instance.
We've been told and advised to look after our health, take out private health insurance. People have been encouraged to
Those that can afford
insurance.
It, yeah.
And I have often said to friends, if I fell on hard times, I would do without my car before I would do without my health insurance. And as a family, we've always had health insurance. Rachel actually has very high level health insurance. So that means if she had no health insurance, she would be costing the state €80 a night. But as it is, she's costing well over 1,000, probably close to 2,000 a day to VHI.
Yeah, as she waits.
As she sits in a queue.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really isn't the issue about private or not. At this stage, I think everybody is equal. You know, I think the insurance applies more if you're looking for, you know, a quick diagnosis or I don't know really. Yeah. Not the point, but it is.
It's an awful shock. And such a young woman, as you say, 34, and so suddenly to have this diagnosis. And as you said, you're just a worried mother who's trying everything
I'm
to try and...
I'm just a worried mother, yeah.
Are you annoyed? Well, annoyed is probably not the wrong word. Frustrated, I don't know what...
Frustrated and helpless.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, like...
Unexpected that this would be the situation in Ireland in 2021 when you get a brain tumour, that you would be left waiting.
You would be left waiting. And, like, I'm wondering, does she have to collapse on the ground? Or, you know, how bad does she have to get? Like, they said they are monitoring. My understanding is that they won't let anything bad happen to her. But so does that mean you have to wait until something bad happens and then it's into an ambulance and straight to, and suddenly it's a very big deal. Yeah. I know the neurosurgeons that do this. This is their job. This is what they do every day. But I don't want her to be on the high end of it.
Oh, well, look at Paula. We'll see what comes of this. And, you know, your last line was to the minister, as a mother, I'm begging you to do something, please, and help save Rachel's life. I'm so afraid that as a result of the delay, she may develop complications or worse. So that's really from the heart. What more can you do?
What more can I do?
Well, we'll keep in touch with you anyway, Paula. And
our
best wishes to Rachel and to yourself and your family as well. And let us know how you get on, and we'll give an update maybe on the programme on Monday as well.
I will indeed.
All right. Mind yourself. Thanks very much for contacting us. Bye, Paula.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now, we took a call yesterday from a listener who was very annoyed at the fact that in bringing a loved one to hospital, they were met with a plume of smoke as people smoked outside the hospital doors, and wondered, is this right, considering that it's a no-smoking zone? And it actually triggered a lot of calls from listeners to explain how addictive smoking is. It's something we've always known about, obviously, but how difficult it is to kick the habit, to the point that even people that are in hospital for smoking-related problems still need to go out and have a cigarette outside the door of the hospital. And Gary, you are listening to us. Good afternoon to you.
And good afternoon to you, Damien.
What age were you when you started smoking?
12.
And how long did you smoke for?
I'm smoking 45 years in total.
But you're off them now?
I'm off them. I'm only off them a short time. I'm off them about 2 weeks now at this stage, okay?
Yeah.
But I don't think people understand how severe the addiction is. Mm-hmm. The addiction is so severe that they maintain to give up heroin is easier than to give up tobacco.
God.
Right?
More addictive than heroin.
More addictive than heroin, right?
Yeah.
And now, I'm off them purely at the moment. Well, I'm off them, hopefully for good, but I'm off them because I'm just going in for a minor thing to get done, but the recovery time is so much quicker if you're not smoking, right?
So on doctor's orders, you've given them up?
Basically.
Okay.
Yeah. But to give you an idea of what goes on, right? For example, the last day, fast asleep at night, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I can still see the dream. I'm sitting at a table with a box of Pall Mall in front of me. Not advertising, right? Okay. But, and I'm having a cigarette. And I'm actually enjoying it. I can see myself actually having a great time with it, right? that's what happens, right? The addiction is so severe, right, that when you actually give them up, right, last week I actually was off for 2 days and I had to go to bed for the 2 days because if I didn't, I was going out to fly cigarettes.
And what's the longest you were off them before this?
10 days at the absolute tops, at the absolute tops.
So you have tried to give up over the years?
About 16, 17 times in total.
God.
And I've done acupuncture. I've done hypnotism. You name it, I've done it. Right?
And was there a time in your life when you actually, you enjoyed smoking? Did you still enjoy it?
I enjoy smoking if I was smoking, yeah.
Yeah, you enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. Like, my mother died from emphysema. My grandmother died from emphysema. And I was still smoking.
And how many would you smoke in a day, Gary?
I used to smoke anything up to 40 ordinary cigarettes, right?
Yeah. What are ordinary cigarettes? Yeah.
That's ordinary, like John Player Blue or any specific brand, you
right,
know, standard
yeah.
cigarette, right?
Yeah.
So then I decided, no, I'd cut them back so I'll buy rolled cigarettes, i.e. tobacco that you would roll yourself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What I didn't realise is that for every single rolled cigarette that you smoke, it's equivalent to smoking 3 standard cigarettes.
Right.
So
there's no filter.
You would use filters and all, but it's just pure tobacco. That's all you're actually smoking, right?
Yeah.
So I was down to 25 a day. And the reason I know this is because a very good nurse that's looking after me in James is Carmel, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're part of the drug rehabilitation clinic, right? Now, they're called smoking cessation. But technically, it's classified as a drug addiction.
Yeah.
Right?
And how much of it is a habit and how much of it is an addiction?
I would say that if I was to classify it either side, like I'm 14 days off them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I make a cup of coffee, the first thing I think of is a cigarette.
And how have you coped over the last 2 weeks? Have you worn patches or how are you actually staying
I'll
off them?
I'll tell you what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I have a 25 milligram patch on my arm. And on average, I'm using, give or take, well, I'm going through 12 boxes of the lozenges as well, which are 4 milligram tablets, right?
Yeah.
So it's an average of about 2 boxes a day, right?
This is nicotine chewing gum or whatever, is it?
No, it's a lozenger that I put in my mouth. Each one of them have 4 milligrams of nicotine in them.
Okay.
So technically, if you worked out the amount of nicotine I was taking a day, it's give or take, I think, about 120 milligrams of nicotine I'm taking a day.
And is that satisfying the want in you?
It is.
Yeah.
Now, it's satisfying the want in me. Part of the reason that it's slightly easier this time, right? Now, when I say easier, I don't mean it's easy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I seem to be accepting it a bit better this time because up to the time where they said, well, look, you have to give up the cigarettes, I was getting to a stage where I was getting frustrated because every time you move as a smoker, and people don't realize this, you've got to find your lighter, you've got to find your cigarettes, and you've got to find an ashtray. You spend your life looking for those 3 items.
Your day, it sounds to me, revolves around thinking and dealing with smoking.
Well, that's it.
The whole time. That's
from the time you get up to the time you go to bed,
yeah.
Your first and last thought is, do I have cigarettes?
Yeah,
now, my own father smoked 100 cigarettes a day.
Jeez.
Right? And he was so bad that if he had, say, 15 left in the box, he'd have to go out and buy 40 cigarettes before he went to bed.
God.
Now, there were different days, you know what I mean? And you see, what I'm saying is people don't get this when they look at smokers. They think, oh, well, that's only a habit he's in.
Mm.
There's more to it than a habit. And you've got to be psychologically ready in your own mind before you can even attempt to give up cigarettes. If your mind isn't in the right place, you'll never give them up. And that's from someone who's tried everything in the book.
And Gary, have you worked it out over the years how much money you've spent on cigarettes?
without sounding stupid, right?
Yeah.
I know I'm spending about £3,500 a year, right?
Yeah.
So multiply that by 45, right? Okay. It's about £200,000.
And when you do maths like that, does that not encourage you to ditch it altogether? Is that not a help in beating the addiction?
No.
No.
And I'll tell you why it's not. Like at the end of the day, okay, depending on your circumstances, right? But no matter what financial bracket you're in, right?
Mm-hmm.
You will always find the money for your cigarettes. A bit like a junkie. And I'm not being, I don't want people to think, oh, everyone out there is a junkie that smokes. They're not. They have a medical condition, right?
Yeah. And Gary, what about your friends and family? You know, they it's become more socially unacceptable to smoke. As you said, there were different times in your dad's time. Everybody was nearly smoking. But our attitudes towards smoking have changed quite a lot, particularly since the smoking ban has actually come in and people are disgusted by it as a filthy habit.
Yeah.
Did you get a bit of that over the years?
You do. And the problem is that, you see, it's like everything else. If you or I were dying of cancer in hospital tomorrow, everyone in the world would be even saying, isn't this terrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because smokers, alcoholics, because they have a medical condition, which is an addiction, people say they're only idiots. But they're killing themselves, not unknowns to themselves. I can tell you, for example, there's over 600 contaminations in every cigarette pull that you put into your mouth.
And do you feel unhealthy as a result of your smoking?
You do, yeah. Mm. I'll tell you now, for the last 2 years or 3 years, I had such a horrendous cough. As you cough. But I had a horrific cough. I would wake up at least four times at night with a cough.
And
the first thing I'd look for.
Are you able to walk up the stairs without getting out of breath? Do you go for a walk or do any exercise?
I do. Believe it or not, I've always exercised. Well, not always exercised. In the last couple of years, I've started exercising and losing weight. But my breathing was horrendous. And my wife used to say to me, Jesus, your breathing is cat, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the last 2 weeks, I haven't had a cough. And my breathing is back to what I would class as normal because I could now run up the stairs.
And does that not encourage you that you're doing the right thing, obviously, and that you're never going to smoke again?
Oh, that absolutely encourages me.
Yeah.
You know, and it does encourage me. And I'll be honest with you, as long as I smoked, I always maintained it was a dirty, filthy habit. Right?
Yeah.
But yet...
You still did it.
I did it. And yet I have people who come home in my vehicle with me, right? To this day, and even from the day I gave them up. And now I'm only off them 14 days, so if we're only short time in here,
after
right?
45. Yeah.
Okay. I still let them smoke in my car. And the reason why I do is because I know what it's like to be gasping for a cigarette.
Yeah. Just stay there. Robbie Moore is on the line. Good afternoon, Robbie.
How are you, Damien?
How many cigarettes were you smoking a day?
60.
60?
Yeah, I wouldn't leave the house in the morning unless I had three packets of cigarettes.
And that was obviously, I mean, the only way you could smoke 60 cigarettes and do a day's work probably was before the smoking ban, am I right?
It was, yeah, and I was driving a truck and they used to nickname me Popeye.
Popeye.
Yeah, everyone seeing me every time, I'd light a cigarette, smoke it, and before it was finished, I'd have another nearly ready.
And
I started smoking when I was six.
Six?
Yeah. I was even smoking the morning before communion.
And was that kind of acceptable even back in the day?
No. My poor mother used to smoke and we used to take them on haul. And any time we were caught wearing, we got a right slapping for it.
Sure.
But at that time you could do that.
I remember when you could buy in the shop what they call a cigarette and a strike, and it was only tuppence.
That's right.
I remember coming out of school, and you go up to the shop and you buy the fag and the strike, and the tuppence was the bus fare.
And then you jump on the back of the bus and hope to change you didn't get caught going home.
And Robbie, how long are you off them now?
18 years.
Which is around the time the smoking ban came in, am I right?
It was, yeah. A month before the date of the smoking ban, I decided that was me done with them. And I got the three packets and I put them in the bin. And that was me. I never looked at cigarettes since.
And that was the ceremony that ended it for you, putting them in the bin.
Oh, yeah, big time. But, like, Damien, if you come into my house tomorrow and you are a smoker, the first thing I'd hand you is an ashtray. Mm. It's your choice if you want to smoke.
No, and but, did you have a longing after you threw the three packets into the bin at all?
I did for nearly 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't give in to it. I had a little Gookie's pen going around in my mouth for 2 weeks.
Right.
And that was the end of that.
So what's your tip to people that want to kick the habit?
Just don't give in to it. Just say that's enough. And that's what I've done.
And did you soon realise the health benefits? Did you feel better in yourself soon after?
Oh, I did, yeah. I did. I felt a lot better. As that chap said there now, I used to get up in the mornings and I'd be coughing and the tears would be coming out of my eyes would be running with the water. Mm. I'd be going up the road and I'd have the two windows open in the truck to get the air in and out of the truck.
Yeah.
Between coughing and smoking. It wasn't putting me off the cigarettes at that time. I just said one day, I got a pain in my head from coughing. And I said, I have to get rid of these.
Now,
can't be going up.
And if that was today, how much is a packet of cigarettes now? 13 quid or something, is it?
In around that, yeah.
12.50.
12.50. So so you'd be spending nearly 50 quid a day, multiplied by 7, 350 a week, multiplied by 4, 12. It's nearly €1,500 a month multiplied by 12. You'd be well into, you'd be about 20 grand you'd be spending. Am I doing my maths right?
Well, you're near enough.
A year?
I was spending nearly €20 for three packets of fags, something like that. €17 or something.
Back 18 years ago, jeez. Yeah,
and I went on a holiday to Checkland races. I had all my money saved, tickets and everything paid for, on the money I was spending on cigarettes. And I had a week's holidays, and I bought a little car. So there you are, and that's only in 1 year.
And you haven't looked back since?
No, but I do see an awful lot of kids smoking now.
Do you really, yeah?
Yeah. I see an awful lot of young kids.
The vape seems to be a big issue with kids now.
The vaping, yeah.
And believe it or not, that's more dangerous because you get what they call popcorn lung from that.
All right. I don't know right. about that.
What that actually does is because of the temperature of the vape, it burns the air sacs in the lung.
Right. Well, anyway...
I see them smoking ordinary cigarettes, all right.
Yeah, I think just don't smoke anything.
That's exactly. Give them up.
Well, give them up and life can only get better in both your cases. You're only 2 weeks into it. Stick at it, Gary. Stick at it. It can be done, as Robbie has attested to there. And thanks very much for contacting us. 51551. Well, just speaking of addiction, Jonathan is on the line. Jonathan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how's things?
We were talking earlier this week, obviously, about the difficulty that people have found themselves in trying to find a accommodation. But you were living where up until 2 years ago?
I was living under a bridge up in Dublin City. And down in Cork before that, homeless for years. And Vincent, Simon and on the streets.
Yeah.
For years.
And how did you find yourself homeless or... how did that come about? What do you put it down to? Is it that you couldn't find accommodation or were there other reasons?
No, addiction. So I started drinking at a very young age. I had my first drink at about 10 years of age. Mm-hmm. And just progressed through that then for a few years. By about 13, 14, I started developing a problem with it. And by about 16, I was an absolute wreck on the drink, like.
And how were you able in those teenage years to get drink?
Well, I suppose back then it was a different time. So, like, my grandmother and all that, like, they grew up in a different time, as you know, like, where drink was very acceptable, like, and there wasn't really any rules around it. So,
but you're not that... What are you? You're only 30 years of age, so it's not...
I'm 30, yeah, so I would have had my first drink around my grandmother.
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But even then, like, that's not that long ago. It's in the millennium. And
that's true, yeah.
Wouldn't have been acceptable. But anyway.
Yeah, but in her eyes, see, because she grew up in a different time.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
A lot of people had their first drink with their
granny. That's my understanding of it, of course.
With their granny. But then, so it was drinking with your granny, that's how it started. But after that then, as you became more addicted to it, how were you able to get the drink or buy the drink? Or?
Well, we used to stand outside off licenses and ask people to go in.
And they would?
You'd stand there as long as you were, as it took, really. And eventually someone would go in, like,
So when you're 13, 14, you're starting secondary school, what was your tipple? What were you drinking?
I was drinking cider, cans of Dutch Gold, anything really. Dutch Gold would have been popular, like.
Mm. And were you drinking alone or were you drinking with other lads?
Well, I'd be drinking with other lads, like older lads. So when I was very young, I started hanging around with an older group, so they'd be about 4 years older than me, you know, so they'd be well on, like, drinking at the weekends and every now here and there, like, they'd be working as well and stuff.
Why were you drinking? If I know it's a funny question, but, like, were you trying to distract yourself away from other things in life, or did you just enjoy it, or was it just a case that you became addicted to it? Why were you drinking so much at that age?
Well, I suppose because I started so young, I just thought it was grand. Like, and because I started hanging around with older fellas then as well, like, I just trying to fit in and just doing what they're doing. And obviously, I liked it.
And were you still?
I enjoyed the feeling of it.
Yeah, and were you still able to go to school and all of that?
I was in school, yeah, but I wasn't really paying attention in school. Like, I kind of gave up on school once I got into secondary school because I had dyslexia and I couldn't really spell that well and stuff, you know, so I didn't get on great in school. So the best option for me at the time was, my mentality was, I'm not getting the things right anyway, so what's the point?
Yeah, and did you make it to Leaving Cert?
No. Oh. I got kind of expelled just before junior cert. So I was expelled, I think it was a few months before the junior cert, but they let me come back and sit the junior cert.
And were you living at home?
Yeah.
And what about parents or brothers, sisters? Did they try and help?
Yeah, so I had a younger brother and sister as well, and my mum and dad, they did try and help, and they done their best, to be fair. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I was a mess. Like, I was constantly causing trouble. I didn't care because I was hanging around with all the fellas and out and around the place anyway. Well, I'd be listening to them, so I didn't really care what anyone else said.
So fast forward on to your 20s and your life is a mess. You're drowning in drink, living under a bridge, accumulated in that in Dublin. So that's when you hit an all-time low. But you've managed to bounce back. I mean, we could continue going through the process of talking about, you know, what happened in your early 20s. But you ended up an absolute mess, totally addicted, living rough under a bridge. How did you manage to turn your life around to where you are now, Jonathan?
So I contacted, through the homeless hostel Simon Community in Cork City, I contacted Tiglin a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
Tiglin up in Ashford, County Wicklow. And after a few months of going through the waiting list and all that, I came in here. And I only stayed 6 months, but it was the first time that I seen what being clean was like, you know.
Yeah.
And so I went back out, but I relapsed straight away, instantly, same day. And it took me 7 years to get back. But I always longed for the feeling that I had up here that time when I was clean, you know.
And you ended up in prison as well during that time?
Yeah, so that would have been before. So that was like between the age of 17 and 23, I was living on the streets in Vincent's and Simon and in and out of prison for them 6 years or whatever. And then I came to Tiglin. And then I went back out and I kind of managed my addiction a bit better at that time, you know. And so I started going from house to house and in the hostels every now and again. For the last 7 years, kind of a job here and there. Kept losing them, of course, you know.
But you kept at it. And where are you now, Jonathan?
I'm working up in Tiglin now at the moment as a support worker.
Right. As a counsellor yourself?
Yeah, well, a support worker, so I'd be helping the lads and talking to the lads and walking towards being a counsellor.
Good man.
You know?
And where are you living now?
Yeah, so I'm living in Teaglin, Carrageedon. So it's the afterhouse down in Greystones.
Oh, God. Lovely part of the world on top of everything else.
Yeah. Like waking up on holidays every day.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So you're living in Greystones and then you're working in Teaglin, as you said, to be a counsellor. So, I mean, your 18-year-old self, would you have pictured where you are now?
Oh, not a chance. Not, like, if you were to speak to me when I was 18, like I often told my parents, I honestly and really believed that's the way my life was meant to be. As I said to my mother years ago, going, like, ye couldn't do nothing for me. No matter where I was born, who our family I grew up in, rich, poor, whatever, I was like, this is destined for me. I didn't think I was capable of anything else.
God. So there is always hope. And you're playing hurling as well, are you?
That's right, yeah. So I joined back. So I used to play hurling when I was very young, with school and all that, and with the bears and stuff. And so I started that again. I just gave it a chance, just to see what the crack was. And it came back pretty fast. I love it, really do.
Who are you playing with? Aeroge, is it?
Yeah, Aeroge and Greystones, yeah.
Good man.
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, there's hope for everybody, you know, when it comes to addiction, listening to your story there, and there's so much more to it, we just don't have time, but in terms, I mean, you were really through the ringer, but thanks to the people there in Teaglin, and you were homeless for other reasons, obviously, to do with, you know, you found yourself in that situation, but you've managed to come out the other side, so to speak, and you've your whole life to look forward to now.
Yeah, thank God.
All right.
Yeah, so it's totally changed around.
All right. Well, Jonathan, good luck to you. Thanks for contacting us.
No bother at all. Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And more people that have managed to give up smoking as well. Anne, good afternoon.
Hi, Damien. How are you?
How many attempts did it take before you...
Well, 7 times over a long period of years.
Yeah.
And I actually was offered, I mean, I'm in my early 70s. I was offered my first cigarette when I first started work. I was 16, and believe it or not, in those days we used to pop to the pub at lunchtime on a Friday for a glass of beer and a packet of crisps. And I remember being offered a cigarette and not really wanting to smoke, but the girl said, oh, it's only the first one or two that taste awesome. You'll enjoy them after that. So, yeah, over a long number of years, I did try to give them up, obviously, for health reasons and the cost and the smell. And I really didn't want to be smoking, but it is just a very severe addiction. I have heard that it's the worst addiction of all to shake off. So I was sort of an expert on giving them up for one reason or another. But what really disgusted me was that sometimes you could find yourself with a few pounds at the end of the week, and you were really looking at whether you should do something proper with it, like maybe buy a loaf of bread, you know, or some fruit, or am I going to buy cigarettes, which is awful.
But again, your point is they are just so addictive indeed. Listen, we're going to leave it there, Anne. Good news, you haven't had a smoke in 20 years. Keep it up, and thanks for giving us a call on the programme today, which was produced by Shannon Gorman. Pather Carney was in sound. Daniel Keating was the broadcast coordinator. Thanks to all our callers. Thanks to you for listening, and I'll talk to you again on Monday. Radar sees next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia e-range of EVs and PHEVs.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. Or email joe@rte.ie.